This is FSRN, the weekly edition. I'm Shannon Young. Coming up on today's show, questions of accountability and long-term health effects loom over the Flint, Michigan water crisis. For the first time in three decades, the U.S. government freezes new applications for coal leases on federal land. And a U.S.-Iran prisoner swap, sanctions, and more. We talk with an American citizen who spent more than a year in solitary confinement in an Iranian prison. Those stories and more on FSRN's Weekly Edition. A public health crisis simmering in Flint, Michigan for nearly 2 years has finally boiled over. The governor has apologized and promised accountability, but it's still unclear how much he knew and when. Tanya Snyder reports.
Flint residents first complained about the brownish color of the water, its strange smell and bad taste, after local officials switched the city's water supply from Lake Huron to the Flint River in 2014 to save money. Other problems soon emerged. Locals complained that their kids were breaking out in rashes and losing hair. Eventually, the kids seemed to be in a sort of mental fog.
We saw one story where a woman told her kids just to take small sips.
That's Sam Inglot, a spokesperson for Progress Michigan, one of many organizations fighting for clean water and accountability in Flint.
When you're a parent and you have no other option but to tell your kids to take small sips of water that you know has the potential to poison them and harm them for their entire lives, that's a situation that nobody should ever have to be in.
The water in the Flint River isn't clean. There were several boil water advisories, and officials added higher and higher levels of chlorine. But chlorine is corrosive, and the water wasn't being treated with an anti-corrosive agent, which would have cost $100 a day. Without it, the water started corroding the lead and iron pipes that carry water throughout the city. The GM plants stopped using city water because it was damaging car parts. A local hospital stopped using it because it was corroding their instruments. Scientific studies showing high lead levels were downplayed by state environmental quality officials. Outreach materials even counseled concerned residents, quote, "Some people may be sensitive to any water. Talk to your doctor," unquote. Privately, officials griped that residents were using the water issue as a sort of political football. Lead exposure in childhood can lower IQs, damage kidneys, and affect nearly every organ in the body. According to a local pediatrician who helped bring the issue to light, lead is the sort of thing that can keep a population down for generations. On Tuesday, Governor Rick Snyder used his State of the State address to issue a mea culpa to the people of Flint.
"I am sorry, and I will fix it. No citizen of this great state should endure this kind of catastrophe. Government failed you."
Snyder said the people of Flint deserve better, that they deserve accountability. The next day, he released 274 pages of emails. The correspondence is damning, showing how officials tried to pass blame onto the city and county, even though Flint was under state-appointed emergency management at the time. Sam Inglot says the attempt to shift the blame is hollow.
"With emergency managers, they have really czar-like powers in their cities. They have the power to dissolve boards, break union contracts, switch entire municipalities over to another water source. And the only elected official in that equation is Rick Snyder."
That's why there's so much attention on what Governor Snyder knew and when. He's the only elected official in the chain of command behind the Flint water crisis. But in Michigan, the governor is exempt from the Freedom of Information Act, and Inglot from Progress Michigan says Snyder is hand-picking which emails to release. President Obama met with the new mayor of Flint on Wednesday.
"And I told her that we are going to have her back and all the people of Flint's back as they work their way through this terrible tragedy. It is a reminder of why you can't shortchange basic services that we provide to our people and that we together provide as a government to make sure that public health and safety is preserved."
The president has declared a federal emergency in Flint, releasing $5 million in federal aid. But he's not calling it a federal disaster, which would free up a lot more money. The former emergency manager of Flint has since gone on to become the new emergency manager of Detroit's school system, where a separate crisis is now brewing. Tanya Snyder, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
There's no end in sight for what some say is the country's biggest environmental catastrophe since the 2010 BP Deepwater Horizon oil spill. A massive leak of methane gas from an underground storage facility in a suburb north of Los Angeles has displaced hundreds of nearby Porter Ranch residents. The leak has persisted since late October when a pipe broke several hundred feet beneath the surface of a 3,600-acre gas field. Environmentalists are sounding the alarm about the leak's effects on greenhouse gas emissions and say that without greater regulation and oversight of the natural gas industry, future gas leaks, large and small, are inevitable. Larry Buell has more from Los Angeles.
But not only is it in the air, it's in my house, it's in my furniture, it's in my body. My daughter, her sons won't come over to our house anymore. She doesn't want them over there anymore because they'll get sick.
They've had their Thanksgiving. They've had their Hanukkah. They've had their Christmas. They've had their New Year. They've had their family celebrations, all disrupted because of irresponsible actions from the state to the gas company.
And there is no reason for any kind of plan to not be in place.
That was Maureen Capra, L.A. County Supervisor Michael Antonovich, and Sherry Darahanian, three of hundreds who attended a hearing on January 8th. All day, residents sickened and forced to evacuate their homes voiced anger with the Southern California Gas Company in front of an independent panel of the South Coast Air Quality Management District. That panel could shut down the entire Aliso Canyon gas storage facility, and that's what most residents who spoke at the hearing want. The slow motion and largely invisible disaster has been unfolding in the dusty foothills north of Los Angeles since October 23rd. That's when an injection well pipe broke. The California Air Resources Board says that, at its height, nearly 60,000 kilograms of methane per hour were released into the air. By December 22nd, a relief well cut the rate of escaping gas in half. On windy days, the strong rotten egg odor caused by an additive to the gas can be smelled miles away in the heavily populated San Fernando Valley. Governor Jerry Brown visited the site earlier this month and declared a state of emergency for the nearby Porter Ranch community. Residents and city officials are blaming SoCalGas for being too slow, for not updating their aging equipment, for not having an emergency plan, and even for misrepresenting the extent of the problem. Los Angeles City Councilman Mitch Englander.
They've been responsive. They've been reactive. They were never proactive. They never had a plan in place. There was never a contingency plan that what happened if one of these wells blew like it did.
Last month, an attorney for SoCalGas admitted the company lied when it said it replaced a safety valve on the well in 1979. The review board says it will make a decision about shutting down the facility as early as next week. Right now, SoCalGas is drilling past the well to plug it at the source, a process it says will take more than a month. Southern California Gas did not respond to requests for comment to this story. Walker Foley is an organizer from Food and Water Watch. He criticizes what he calls a too cozy relationship between industry and regulators.
What we've seen in Governor Brown's tenure in these last few years is that he's made really aggressive moves to deregulate the entire industry. And as a result, we're permitting things we shouldn't. We're not funding the regulatory agencies the way they should be. And as the LA Times has been reporting, the regulatory agencies are actually deferring to the industry on how best to do their own jobs. It's a real sham.
More than 25 lawsuits have been filed against the utility. The California Public Utilities Commission could issue massive fines and penalties, but has yet to do so. Beyond the immediate impact to surrounding communities, the leak is raising questions about the state of the country's extensive natural gas infrastructure. As natural gas surpasses coal as a leading energy source, outdated and decaying pipes and facilities could lead to more disasters like Aliso Canyon, whose storage facilities and pipes are more than 60 years old. Amy Townsend Small is a geology professor at the University of Cincinnati. She says massive and sustained gas leaks like Aliso Canyon could also accelerate climate change.
Methane, the predominant component of natural gas, is a really powerful greenhouse gas. It's somewhere between 30 and 80 times more powerful than CO2 at trapping heat. A rapid increase in methane emissions potentially could trigger some of these scary tipping points like destabilization of ice sheets or ocean currents.
The EPA is in the process of creating federal rules that will, for the first time, directly regulate oil and gas emissions. But they will only address future oil and gas facilities, not existing ones. And those regulations won't do anything to help residents near the Aliso Canyon facility right now. Larry Buell, FSRN, Los Angeles.
You're listening to FSRN Free Speech Radio News, independent, non-commercial media. To find out how you can support FSRN, visit our website, fsrn.org. The federal government is reviewing a program that allows coal companies to lease federal lands. The Obama administration has announced a freeze on new applications for coal mining leases for the duration of the review period. Not surprisingly, responses are mixed. Some support the pause on new applications, saying it fits with other newly established White House climate-conscious policies. Opponents say this is another attack in the war on coal. FSRN's Hannah Lee Myers has more.
Around 40% of all the coal produced in the United States comes from federal lands. Those mines employ thousands of Americans, and last year alone, coal mining operations paid the U.S. government $1.3 billion in leasing fees. The Bureau of Land Management, the federal body responsible for managing coal mining federal land leases, anticipates the process to review its current leasing system could take up to 3 years. During that time, government researchers will work on improving transparency in the coal leasing program. The assessment will factor in returns to taxpayers, along with measuring the social, health, and environmental costs of extracting coal from federal lands. Diana Orff, government affairs consultant to the Colorado Mining Association, says this moratorium on new leases ignores improvements in coal mining techniques.
The current system is actually working quite well. So we don't understand why there is a need for a top-to-bottom review at this point. It seems unnecessary and just creates uncertainty in our industry.
Orff points to a 2014 report by the U.S. Energy Information Administration showing that coal accounts for 40% of all the energy produced in the United States, and most of that coal energy comes from western states, like Colorado. A large majority of coal produced in western states is extracted from federal lands. Orff says the industry in general will suffer from what she calls another attack in the war on coal.
It seems we're being hit from all sides. It appears that they are removing the opportunity to mine the coal for anything in the future. So it's a grim outlook. We believe this is a very impactful move on the part of the federal government.
New pollution regulations, faltering international coal markets, and the booming natural gas industry have dropped coal production and related jobs to their lowest level since the 1980s. Just days after the moratorium announcement, President Obama told an audience in Baton Rouge that when looking at the decline in the coal industry, it's best to focus on what will benefit Americans long term, particularly those who work in the energy sector.
Those communities that are reliant on coal, we should help them get a jump on making money in wind power and solar power. Those are hard-working, good people. Let's not have them stuck in old jobs that are going to be slowly declining. Let's get them in the new jobs that are going to be going up.
Many environmentalists, like Jeremy Nichols, director of Wild Earth Guardians Climate and Energy Program, agree.
And if you're in the coal business right now, admittedly, it's rough, but we move beyond destructive industries. We have a long history in this nation of realizing that certain products or certain industries are not in our interest to sustain, and you know that's where the coal industry is at.
It's been 3 decades since the U.S. government has formally reviewed the coal industry's use of federal lands for extraction. Nichols predicts that the assessment will lead to a major policy shift.
Our expectation, frankly, is that this process will lead to the institution of reforms that will ultimately keep coal in the ground, basically end the federal coal program.
Nichols gained notoriety in 2013 when his organization sued the federal government over the expansion of a coal mine in one of the West's top coal-producing counties, and won. Nichols says that victory and this new coal mine application pause suggest broader implications.
I mean, this is significant. This is for the first time the U.S. Department of the Interior acknowledging it has a serious climate problem on its hands and that something needs to be done to fix it. And the fact that they issued a moratorium on new coal leasing, it's not unprecedented, but it is unprecedented because climate has been the biggest driver for this action. So it's huge. It's a watershed moment.
The Department of the Interior says this moratorium on new coal mine leases on federal lands will halt around 30 applications, including coal mine expansion projects. But the DOI also predicts the coal industry will maintain the ability to operate at current levels of production for the next two decades. Organizations and individuals on both sides of the issue seem to agree that the Obama administration is working to solidify a presidential legacy on climate policy, adding this halt on new coal mines on federal land to other recent environmental actions, like the Clean Power Plan and strengthened water and air regulations. Hanalei Myers, FSRN, Denver.
This week marks the 43rd anniversary of the Supreme Court ruling on Roe v. Wade, a case that legalized abortion. This year, the High Court is due to hear another potentially landmark abortion case, Whole Woman's Health v. Cole. Plaintiffs argue that a Texas law known as HB2 violates the 14th Amendment by placing an undue burden on women seeking abortion services in the state. HB2 mandates abortion clinics in Texas meet the standards of ambulatory surgical centers and requires doctors performing or inducing abortions have admitting privileges at hospitals within 30 miles. Proponents of the 2013 law argued it would make abortions safer, but providers say the requirements were a political move intended to shutter clinics through expensive and unnecessary regulations. The initial implementation of HB2 reduced the number of abortion clinics in Texas by more than half. Many of the 18 clinics still open operate under the terms of a temporary stay. If the Supreme Court ultimately upholds the law, all but 9 or 10 abortion clinics in 5 metropolitan areas will have to permanently shut down. Court documents estimate around 60,000 women seek an abortion in Texas each year.
The thought that a handful of remaining clinics in Texas can absorb the demand of our state's residents is utterly absurd.
That's Jenny Braun, former CEO and director of Ruth Street Women's Clinic, an independent abortion provider forced to close after 37 years operating in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. The clinic temporarily suspended its services as challenges to HB2 wound through the courts, but shut down permanently in June of 2015. Braun says that before the clinic shuttered completely, Ruth Street physicians saw an increase in women trying to self-induce abortions.
We did have patients come in that had obtained what they thought was Cytotec. We have no idea what it really was, at various flea markets or on the black market. And some patients had taken like 10 or 12 of those, which could be devastating.
As the number of clinics authorized to provide abortions in the state dwindled, wait times increased. Dr. Daniel Grossman is an investigator with the Texas Policy Evaluation Project, which published a study this month on how clinic closures have affected women's access to abortion services. Grossman notes that after the Ruth Street Clinic closed, wait times for an appointment at the area's remaining facilities increased from what was already around 20 days.
Just this past December, these wait times in Dallas and Fort Worth increased to as long as 28 days for the first consultation and the mystery calls that we've been doing. And clinics said that it would likely be another 2 weeks after that before the procedure could be performed.
These extended waits, Grossman adds, have had a secondary effect, pushing more terminations into the second trimester.
The fact that HB2 is increasing later abortion is concerning from a public health perspective, since it is well documented that although second trimester abortion is very safe, it is associated with a higher risk of complications compared to early abortion. It's also more expensive for women, and there are fewer providers of later abortion.
The wait times and often long distances to the nearest in-state clinic have prompted some women to seek care outside of Texas. After the birth of her second child, doctors told Valerie Peterson she was no longer able to conceive. However, when surprised by a third pregnancy, Peterson decided to have the baby and began prenatal care. But by week 16, tests confirmed severe developmental irregularities in the brain and spinal cord that would not allow the baby to survive outside of the womb.
My doctor gave me two options. I could continue to carry the pregnancy to term, and I would eventually miscarry or give birth to a stillborn baby, or I could terminate the pregnancy.
Peterson opted for the latter. Although she lives in a city with an open abortion clinic, she soon discovered that wait times ranged upwards of 3 weeks. She says that added agony to what was already emotional devastation. A friend referred her to a doctor in Florida, and Peterson immediately booked an appointment.
So what I did have to do, of course, is secure an airline ticket. I had to secure hotel, and I had to stay hotel multiple days just to make sure that everything was going to go all right with the procedures. I had to secure care for my daughter, who was at home.
In all, Peterson estimates the out-of-state abortion cost more than $5,500. Meanwhile, those abortion providers still able to operate in Texas report severe strain on their resources. Of the 10 facilities that could remain open if the Supreme Court upholds HB 2, half are operated by Planned Parenthood. Ginny Braun of the now-defunct Ruth Street Women's Clinic says even if the High Court overturns HB 2, there are no plans to reopen the facility she used to run.
It's sort of like once Humpty Dumpty has fallen off the wall, you really can't put him back together. So at this time, I'm still working on issues related to the closure of the clinic, such as equipment leases, taxes. As you may know, independent providers are taxed at 35%, not like some of the Planned Parenthoods. So just because we're closed does not mean that the expenses have stopped.
The Supreme Court is due to hear arguments on Whole Woman's Health versus Cole on March 2nd. You are listening to the weekly edition of Free Speech Radio News, listener-funded grassroots news coverage. Find out more at fsrn.org. A prisoner exchange with Iran resulted in 11 people freed from prisons last Saturday, 7 Iranians from U.S. prisons and 4 dual citizens from Iranian detention. A 12th person was also released, though separately from the swamp. The Americans freed include Washington Post reporter Jason Rezaian, former Marine Amir Hekmati, and a Christian minister, Saeed Abedini. The prisoner exchange came amid a week of rapid diplomatic events. Iran briefly detained 10 U.S. soldiers. The IAEA certified that Tehran had in fact met requirements under the Iran nuclear deal to curtail its nuclear capabilities, and the U.S. announced the lifting of sanctions against Iran. But just after the released American hostages left Iran, the U.S. Treasury Department announced a new round of sanctions, this time on less than a dozen specific groups and people allegedly involved in Iran's ballistic missile program. FSRN's Nell Abrams spoke with Sarah Shord, one of 3 U.S. hikers detained by Iran in 2009. Shord spent 14 months in solitary confinement in an Iranian prison before her 2011 release.
First, Sarah, all told, 5 prisoners were released Saturday from Iranian jails, 7 from U.S. jails. Your reaction?
Well, it's an absolutely stunning and wonderful moment. I mean, when I heard the news, I literally just cried tears of joy. I've been walking alongside these men and their families, and of course, I've walked in their shoes. I know what they've been going through, and I know what lies ahead for them now that they're finally coming home.
The prisoner swap came just hours before the International Atomic Energy Agency verified that Iran has met the requirements of the Iran nuclear deal, and U.S. President Barack Obama announced the end to sanctions, effectively unfreezing about $100 billion in Iranian funds. How do you think these developments were all interwoven?
Well, I think it was all a carefully laid out plan. I mean, this is really brilliant diplomacy in action. I wish it had happened decades ago, and I particularly wish it had happened 5 years ago so that I didn't have to sit in solitary confinement for 410 days and my husband and friend didn't have to sit in prison for 2 years. I mean, I asked Obama myself after my release to do a prisoner swap. And at that time, it wasn't politically viable. And now it is. Everything's lined up. This is the moment. And it's a game-changing, you know, historic moment. It sets an incredible precedent. In particular, the prisoner swap, which no one's talking about, these 7 Iranians being released from U.S. prisons. these people, I don't know their names, I don't know their faces, but this is just as joyful of a moment for them, being reunited with their families, being able to go home. And these people were, you know, convicted of sanctions violations. We didn't hurt anyone. They didn't do anything violent. They broke the law, perhaps inadvertently. From what I've heard from a lot of Iranian Americans, sometimes you want to send something home to your family. You don't realize that you're breaking a law until you get a knock at your door. And this is, you know, very symbolic of what this toll that sanctions have been taking on innocent Iranians, normal citizens, both here and, of course, especially in Iran, for decades, and, you know, particularly in the last 5 or more years as we've been amping them up unilaterally. Iranian people are ecstatic right now to be finally released from that burden, that unfair burden of sanctions.
Yet despite this sea change in diplomatic relations between the U.S. and Iran, just one day later, the U.S. announced new sanctions. This time, though, against 11 specific entities and individuals that U.S. authorities say are involved in ballistic missile systems. Do you think this could unravel the detente?
You know, I hope not. The worst part of it for me was that Hillary Clinton made a public statement supporting these new sanctions before the plane had left the ground with Jason and Saeed and Amir on it. I can just put myself in their shoes. If I had been them, I would have just been terrified, and their families. But luckily, that didn't derail the process. But I think it was a clear message from Clinton and from this administration that they're going to continue to play hardball and, you know, be tough on Iran. I mean, I don't know if it was to score political points on Clinton's part or what, but to be honest with you, I haven't looked into every detail of these new sanctions, but I, in some cases, am okay with very focused sanctions against some of the figures inside Iran. Like, for example, my judge, the judge that convicted Shahid Jash of espionage, Judge Salavati is called the hangman judge because he's ordered the execution of so many political dissidents inside Iran, including my friend from prison, Sahra Bahrami, who was convicted of smuggling drugs into Iran. And I believe she was innocent because she was picked up at a pro-democracy protest and then she was executed. And so for many Iranians to have sanctions against these individuals, these hardliners that are undermining democracy and the future of Iran, is not such a bad thing. I have to look into the specifics, but if they're targeted, not targeting the Iranian people, but targeting the hardliners inside Iran that are undermining the fight for democracy by the Iranian people, then I'm actually okay with it.
Sarah Short is a journalist and playwright. Along with two others, Shord was detained by Iran while hiking in 2009. After 14 months in solitary confinement, she was released in 2011. You can find more information about her work and the July opening of her play, The Box, on her website, sarahshord.com. For FSRN, I'm Nell Abram.
And that does it for this week's program. FSRN is supported by stations that air our show and by listeners like you. Visit our website to support our work and to find downloadable audio and transcripts of stories heard in today's program. Nell Abram provides administrative and editorial services from Tampa, Florida. Robert Packard provides technical support from WTJU in Charlottesville, Virginia. Music in today's show is by Sapiens FX. From Oaxaca, Mexico, I'm Shannon Young. Thanks for listening.